some science. And if anyone has watched or listened to LaRouche's speech on the 11th, they know what is LaRouche's position on Obama. And they also might suppose, and they're right, to suppose that Mr. Obama is not necessarily happy from the speech, from from our contacts or networks in around the presidential administration. Mr. Obama is not pleased, but as Mr. LaRouche said, he said, well, what he had to say had to be said so that we can actually move forward and not necessarily criticize Obama like for everything, although criticism has its place. But to look more in terms of the traps that are set up against Obama, because the enemy knows, as Mr. LaRouche pointed out, they know that Mr. Obama is quite, I guess it's quite easy to profile and to be brought into a situation where he's going to actually bring a lot of people down with him. And, you know, and if the United States go down these days with the financial crisis that we have, most of the other nations will just follow. So I'm going to touch on the... machine. Want me to be louder? What Mr. LaRouche was saying is that there are many changes that has to be done very quickly around the president, especially getting rid of a certain faction of what I'm going to talk about, behaviorists, economists, but mostly psychologists. Of people that ask, they ask weird questions, and there's a few I was thinking about. But anyway, first, the idea is that there is what Mr. LaRouche identified is a faction of what we call behaviorist economists who are advising very seriously or very directly the President Obama. Not necessarily on economic policies, but more on psychological policies. So we're in an era where the problem is not the economy, but it's the people. If there's a problem, we can probably whether fix it through changing people's behavior or just get people to forget about it. Not only to forget about it, but actually more like feeling guilty about it, putting the blame on the population itself instead of looking at the biggest swindle in 600 years of human civilization. And that obviously makes a lot of bankers in Wall Street very happy to know that they have nothing to they don't have to feel responsible for the crisis, but actually the people are. And maybe I'm going to start by asking you a question, but they have these sort of questions that they...
Sorry, can you just clarify that? The word coming out of these behavioralists is that it's the people that are to blame?
Yeah, is that the... Well, I'll just read you a quote from the Time magazine. It will illustrate... In the Time magazine, there's an article that LaRouche... talked about during his webcast about these behaviorists. Actually, it's actually a group of 29 behavioral economists, and just a little. They talk about the Obama campaign, right? And now they talk about the Obama presidency, and it's pretty much the way these guys are thinking. It says, in fact, Obama is betting his presidency on our ability to change our behavior. His top priorities, the economy, healthcare, and energy, all depend on it. We need to spend more money now to avert a short-term depression, then save more money later to secure our long-term economic future. We need to consume less energy in order to reduce our oil imports and carbon emissions, as well as our household expenses. We need to quit smoking, lay off the Twinkies, and avoid other risky behaviors that both damage our personal health and boost the cost of care that are ravaging the nation's fiscal health. Basically, we need to make better choices about mortgages and credit cards, insurance and retirement plans, so we won't need bailouts down the road. The problem, as anyone with a sweet tooth, an alcoholic relative, or a maxed out Visa card knows, is that old habits die hard. Temptation is strong. We are weak. We've got plenty of gurus, talk show hosts, and celebrity spokespeople badgering us to save energy, lose weight, and live within our means, but we're still addicted to oil, junk food, and debt. It's fair to ask whether we're even capable of changing. So, basically, if the whole physical economy is collapsing, like the hospital are shutting down, well, you could actually maybe reinvest in hospital and rebuild hospital. Or you could tell anyone who's fat with diabetes that they're the reason why hospitals are crowded, right? And that's the idea of the Twinkie, right?
You have cancer? Why did you smoke, you stupid ass? That's your fault.
And the person with certain psychological tricks, there are people that will feel guilty. So, yeah, like... We heard that before, right? Hospitals are overcrowded. People have, you know, they have a little pain here in the back and they go to the doctor and they wait for 10 hours and we're overcrowding our hospitals. Or, as in this article by another of these behaviorists, a guy named Richard Thaler, who's one of the main behaviorists, wrote an article that basically if you lost your pension fund or you lost all the money that you invested, it's a behavioral problem. It's your behaviorist, which is to blame. So he says, aging Americans are facing a perfect storm when it comes to retirement, Thaler says, you know, because of the whole financial crisis. Many have done little saving over the past two decades and have now seen what they have saved, either in their 401k or their home equity, decline sharply in value. Once they face these facts, Americans will have to relearn the saving habit. Yeah. So, you know, you could say, okay, let's save money. It's an important thing. But why would someone bring those questions? Well, it's obvious that the whole financial system itself is just falling apart. You know, would you blame someone who put his money in the Caisse de Dépôt? He says, well, you lost a quarter of your value. Well, did you save? Did you even save more? I said, well, no, I had this pension fund. Well, here you go. Right? So it's a bit more also not tricky, but it goes back. It's not just didn't just happen like, you know, a couple of years ago these guys came together, but it's a very old tradition which goes back to people like Bernard Mandeville, who were people that said that the wealth of a society comes actually from its private vices. That private vices are a public virtue. Therefore, because the man is this animal which obeys to pleasure and pain and looks for pleasure and try to avoid pain, this is going to be your indicator for your economy. This is what you're going to promote as the measure. So if people want to play in a casino, well, you hire people to build a casino, so that creates jobs, right? And then people have they develop dependencies. So you hire psychologists, you hire, and then you have, you know, you can think about Las Vegas and say, well, that's, you know, Las Vegas is to prove that Bernard Mendeville is right, because there's a shitload of money there, right? Also, I also learned that actually you can get a bus ride for free if you're like an old guy with like old people. They go to the home folk. The bus goes to the home folk, bring them down to spend money for free. So
it's like sort of like public transportation.
Yeah.
It's a really bizarre.
That's nice. And to pick people and say, hey, man,
yeah,
do you want to have some fun today? We can bring some chicks and stuff and we'll send the car. I mean,
yeah, because
you can see that on Discovery. It's not big.
And see, what the behaviorists will say is that that's a way, this home folk thing, it's a way to profile people. Because you could say, well, these old people, they actually don't have much to do. They're getting bored. And a lot of them would just say, well, okay, I'll go. I'll go spend my $20. My grandmother used to say that she would go to the casino and it was $20. Right? But obviously, at a certain point, people, they spend their whole money. And behaviorists would agree that that's a way to change someone's behavior. If you were to charge them, they'll probably hesitate. If they have to do if they have to call the bus guy by themselves, they probably won't go. But if you just send it, they have a harder time saying no than just say, well, okay, why not, and just jump in, right? So they're talking about these things about how you can influence the population, but not just to do these little things like consumption, but really to bring or to keep people on the bestial level. And it goes back to this idea of social engineering. Well, you wanna have people trying to answer these questions. Like, there was this question. I'll read this one, and I have maybe two others that go in the same direction. But let me just find the. Oh no, that's it. They do these. That's what these guys do, right? They do a lot of tests. They do a lot of. Surveys to see how people are thinking, and then this one that maybe people had heard before. But okay, let's say I ask a question to the people. I say, you must deal with a public health epidemic threatening 600 people. So the first question, one course of action would save 200, the other has a 1/3 chance of saving 600 in a 2/3 chance of saving none. Which would you choose? Right? So you're in that situation where, you know, the first action saved 200, so 400 dies.
Are you allowed to ask what the actions would be?
Yeah, are you going to kill them yourself or something? The other has a 1/3 chance of saving 600, so you have 33% of chance to save everyone, and then a 2/3 chance of saving none. Well, that's, yeah. So which do you choose? Then the second question. One course of action will result in 400 deaths. The other has a 2/3 chance of 600 deaths and a 1/3 chance of no death. Which would you choose? And if you can also, I mean, I use that example because I went through that, but this idea of
learning how to get it.
It's this idea of like you're 8 people on a desert island, and you have to eliminate someone because there's not enough food on the island. So you have 8 type of people, an old lady, a gardener, a dog, and then you have these group of students who have to discuss about who to eliminate.
But that's simple.
Well, that's the thing, because in the discussion. In that discussion, things get a lot more complicated because people, maybe they fall in the trap and they say, well, what about this old lady? And what about the... And you have a guy who has an arm missing. Or, you know, you're in your group and you're discussing about who eliminating. And in your group, you have an old woman. You say, well...
Maybe. What do you think?
yeah, what do you think? Yeah. So
those are group discussions?
Like in my philosophy class, like third class at the CEGEP, I had to do that.
The dog won't say no, man. The the dog. The dog,
yeah, you can kill the dog and eat it, so maybe you may be able to feed people. But the idea is that they make this scenario where people actually, the idea is that you get people to just lose their humanity by having these.
Themselves.
Yeah, it's like this, the law of the jungle. Put you in the jungle, you know. Who would you, if you had to choose, who would you kill between your son and your daughter? What the hell are you talking about?
The one who's posing the motherfucking question.
So, and that's called, that's what they call, it's called a recent choice.
Recent.
R-E-E-S-I-N. No. Comes from a John Rawling Rees, who is a Tavistock, says a Tavistock brainwasher. Because it's a funny thing, but it actually started with, these guys started by being involved in the Israeli military on the psychology department. That's how they started. And you know, the military, they do these sort of things, that these utopian factions really think in terms of, you know, that the best way to keep someone vanquished is really to control his brain and to get him to actually put the shackles on himself, on his mind, so you don't have to, you just have to promote a lie or an idea or a scheme to keep people happy. And that's the thing with British economics, that this idea of mankind, this idea coming from Paulo Sarpi, that mankind obeyeth through his senses, mainly, and not as rational, because he's looking for pleasure, wants to avoid pain. And that's the way you should understand economics, and that's what these guys are saying to Obama, who's the other one here. Because, well, I think the key thing, which is a good paradox, well, that's not important, because I'll tell you here, but the behavioral group that was started in the 30s was started by a guy named Alfred P. Sloan, S-L-O-A-N, and today it's still the Alfred Sloan Foundation, which is active with the Russell... I forget the name, but I think it was the Russell Foundation or something like that.
Founder of this behavioral science.
Yeah.
Behavioral.
He found the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation based on behavioral economics. But the same guy, and that's where it becomes very important, because the same guy founded with John G. Raskob the American Liberty League that we know as an institution. Attacking Franklin Roosevelt, attacking his idea of a government, defending free trade, but more than that, defending Mussolini and Hitler, right? So this is the faction that, in a reaction to Roosevelt, well, not probably there before, right? Because they were pretty much a cartel, controlling parts of the United States economy, General Electric,
DuPont.
Actually, even the singer, the sewing machine. and the difference is that, you know, when you think about people like Milton Friedman, and you think about free trade in general, or what we hear today, we hear this idea of don't interfere in the market, let the market correct itself. Right, like the magic hand, the invisible hand of Adam Smith. Well, the problem they have now is that the system is all collapsing. So, can't just let the market do its thing, because it's getting a bit stressful. To say, is it going to come back? Is it going to adjust itself? So, this idea of behaviorism takes a new form, and it goes very far, as I'll. I first thought this was a joke, but it's probably true. There are two guys named Dan Ariely and George Lewinstein, wrote a paper called, and I hope it's true. It's called The Heat of the Moment, The Effect of Sexual Arousal on Sexual Decision Making. And it says, male college students were asked questions about sex-related subjects, and their answers were compared before and while masturbating. So it's really like all about, you know, pleasure. You know, like.
I'll ask you again. Tick, tick, tick. Hello. Yes.
All the questions were the same, but they're tainted with more embarrassment.
But see, I think we all, I mean, being organizers, we dealt with that before. In a sense of that, when we talk to the people in the street, we see certain reactions where people will blame the crash on stupidity of the population. Mm-hmm. We hear that, even in the United States too, people will say, well, why did they take these stupid house loans? Why did they take the subprime mortgage?
They elected them twice.
Yeah. Where they say, well, GM collapsed because they didn't follow the Japanese model. Because the Japanese are smarter.
They're gas guzzlers.
The gas guzzlers.
Too big car.
Oh, yeah. That's their fault. And, you know, everything is called.
Is biofuel part of the evolution of technology? And, like, supposedly you can go to coal burning wood for coal burning to oil.
Oh, no, because you use food. See, the thing, you have to choose between food that will feed a car or feed a human being. And the human being is the basis of your economy.
Okay.
So it's a step back.
Human beings eat bio. Maybe biological food.
Make food with corn. Because biofuel you can do with corn, with sugar cane, blah, blah. But don't... Yeah, but don't...
Also, the process of turning it into fuel is very, very energy.
Yeah.
Wasteful.
And so... Either way, you lose.
Yeah.
So,
die or die.
Well, just eat food and live.
Yeah.
All right. So coming back to behavior. So these are the people that, and some are even close friend to Obama, who've been advising him. And LaRouche has compared that to, he compared pretty much our situation with. The Roman Empire with Nero, that the leader himself, if he doesn't stop acting like a jerk, will do like Nero, who erased or eliminated his good advisors and kept the crazy ones that were profiling him and driving him crazy up to the destruction of Rome itself, right? And, we are in a financial crisis, the gravest crisis in the history of mankind. And we can't just say, well, we're going to tweak people's behavior and make things okay. The problem is a systemic problem. There's there's actually a fight between, I would say, two visions of mankind. One that says, well, man is just an animal that if you keep him tamed and very happy, it's not going to bother you because he's an animal and he's going to be... going to have his belly filled. And this other approach, which is what we're talking about, is that, well, man has a certain responsibility in the biosphere, in the universe itself. So I'm not going to go into that, but I really, well, I'll just say that on the 26th of April, we'll be projecting, screening the April 11th webcast of Mr. LaRouche at Concordia. It's going to be at 7, and people should invite their friends, people will think should be interested.
What day of the week is that?
It's a Sunday. Because LaRouche goes into many axioms about human development, about human history, and about science as well. But I think the best way to the best way to intervene, because it, in what we're talking about here, and what we're going to see with math, it's it might not seem obvious at the beginning, but these are ideas that we have to use to organize the population. LaRouche is confident that the change can happen despite Obama's limitation, which are numerous. Although he's not an idiot compared to the former president, that with the proper type of coaching or advisors, we can get out of this crisis easily. No, but we can actually do it because of the crisis, because the usual controllers are being challenged. I mean, there's probably millions of economists in the world who find themselves discredited by what's going on. They're still trying to make these forecasts, you know, that the economy is going to get back in shape not too long, in a couple of years. But there's absolutely nothing to back it up. So these guys have lost credibility. And the population will look for someone who has some type of a plan. And that's where obviously we come in, and that we can challenge the population to understand those principles, not just to, you know, like becoming a cheerleader for LaRouche or something. People have to put themselves in this situation where they're going to be organizing politicians, community leaders, city councilors, and at a certain point, being the center of this academic recovery that we're talking about. And because there's he's going to touch on one other subject and then go into certain priorities that Mr. LaRouche has stressed out not too long ago, actually after his speech. Yeah, okay. Because one thing that came up a lot this week is this whole thing about drug legalization. We have our movement in Mexico, because see what I said at the beginning, I was talking about not necessarily Obama himself, but to look for the traps that are set so that Obama could fall into and then drive the whole world to the brink of the abyss. And one of them, actually there are two, but there's an attempt, there's going to be two attempts to get Obama to actually rebuke what he said about this fight on the war on drugs. Because we saw when Obama went to Mexico, Hillary Clinton, sorry. There was a very good discussion about how to fight that, how to stop the war on drugs.
Calderon?
Yeah, she met with a couple of people. I think Calderon was also met.
But Obama was with Calderon today.
Was with Calderon today. Okay, oh yeah, yeah, true, because... Yeah, I just mixed up the date. Because there was a report by the activity of our youth members in Mexico, mm-hmm. where they actually intervened in one of those conferences where everyone agreed about drug legalization. Let's stop the war. It never worked. And... look, we're in a financial crisis, so why don't we just take the money of the drug cartel, of the drug traffic, the drug trade, and we could make like $100 billion. Wow. And that, I mean, that's those are the arguments. But our people intervened, attacked the city of the British Empire, that this is a new opium wars, a new opium war on the people of South America. In Mexico, and at the end, I don't have the thing on me, but like we do sometimes, we did a couple of interventions, and when people were finishing their speech, our youth members just opened a big banner, attacking the people that were there as being British pawns, and they started singing a song, Bel Canto, like about this whole funny. Thing about drugs, and obviously they were covered by some television, some newspapers, because the idea is that at that conference and in Mexico, well, see, the idea is that the the killing and the suffering is present. So people that have good hearts, they will say, well, can we just stop the killing? So maybe we should legalize. Maybe we should just, you know, start doing business and maybe the violence will stop. So people stopped fighting. They say, well, why don't we just agree to the least worst, right? So our role is really to kick those guys in the butt and to give them some strength, right? Some something that they can chew on and keep fighting. Because I think, I forgot where it comes from, but that's something that was reported in our briefing, that actually 12 mayors, I forgot if it was in the Mexico region of Mexico City, but when you have 12 mayors that are killed in this violence between the narco terrorists and you know what's left of the government, you see these guys are very well prepared. They're not just killing poor in the street. They're killing people that are in the establishment, in the government, in the police.
Because they are with the police.
Yeah, but not just that.
They cannot exist without cooperation with the police.
But
that's logically impossible.
No, but the point is that they have, I mean, there are people in Mexico, Colombia fighting those guys. But the problem is that when they fight them, they realize that these guys have, like, yeah, probably have more weapons than any army or as the equivalent. So you think you're going to fight some, like, you know, these guys are not like pushers in the corner of the street. These guys are well armed. They actually have helicopters and stuff like that.
They're not a mere gang.
Yeah, it's not like a gang of, you know, of teenagers pushing some marijuana. There are armies. And let's repeat it, in Colombia, they actually control the territory, which is as big as Switzerland. So that, and they the people there are just working for them like slaves. They actually take hostage not just people but villages. So they can't. So it's a dangerous situation. It's a civilizational crisis.
That's happening right now.
Yeah.
The same as Colombia was actually having some progress in keeping it out.
Well, they do.
That's all changed.
Well, they do have progress, but like. But as we saw, we had this picture with Raul Reyes and President Grasso from the New York Stock Exchange, you know,
yeah,
hugging
yeah.
each other. There is progress, but it's still a force in itself. The narco terrorists are there still. They can be crushed. But as Arush says, the effort is still not quite there. We had some good shot recently, mm-hmm. even here. With the Hells Angels, maybe people heard, but almost all members of Hells Angels were arrested recently. I guess it was like 100 or so people arrested, and there's going to be charge pressed on them of murder of different things. That was the biggest catch since 2001.
186.
186, okay. And that's all in the paper. Hells Angels are going to, you know, they're collapsing. And so the point is not to say, oh, okay, we've done our job, it's over. But, you know, organized crime is organized crime. They're organized, so you need to keep a constant pressure on that. But, well, you know, we talked about behaviorism, controlling people's behavior. Well, if you have people on drugs, they're you know pretty I guess they're pretty their behavior is easy to expect or to forecast, right? So that's like super behaviorism, having people on drugs. And but so there's the thing, Obama is here today, so you have all these interventions in Mexico, also the former president Castaneda, and people also from I think is a marijuana policy project. People writing in different newspapers, the Financial Times as well, Washington Post, and just saying, you know, forget this war. Never mind the war. It's unjust, right? Because you don't want to put poor people in jail with their little joint. But that's not the point. The point that we're dealing with organized crime. And whatever you legalize, you're not going to just shut down those guys with guns and helicopters and say, like signing a piece of paper will get these guys to disappear somehow. Oh, man, I got to get a job now. Right? Something like that. I got to stop killing. Oh, shit. These guys are there. They're an army. They're a private army working against nation states. And there's also, I don't have much on that, but there's going to be a conference in Thailand on the subject of drug, where people from the United States were invited. I'm not sure. I forget if the president was supposed to be there. But now in Thailand, there's a lot of... the government is completely unstable. There's riots in the streets. But it's one of those other... It's one of those other cases where they say, well... they build up the violence and they say, well, wouldn't you rather legalize? Wouldn't it be better? Right? It's like these other, like this behaviorist question. You know, you have to choose. If you have to choose between putting people on drugs and stopping the killing, or like, you know, having to fight all the time against those drug pushers, like, which one would you do? And they're like, well, I don't like to fight. Fighting is not good. Maybe, you know, people when they're smoke joint, they're peaceful. So maybe. But no, we have to be very tough on that. You know, we're not going to improve people's creativity through LSD or smoking.
What if you compare this to the prohibition? I mean, what's the big difference?
What's the big difference between that and prohibition?
Yeah.
Well, you see, prohibition, the problem is that what it did is that it actually transformed criminals into businessmen.
Yeah.
But those criminals groups, I mean, they're criminals. The drug, I mean, the alcohol was such crap at the time. I mean, you had people dying of, because it wasn't beer, but like these the spirituals. You know, like high alcohol beverage?
Homemade moonshine, stuff like that.
Yeah. But stuff were like, I mean, it was just sick. But people like the Bronfman, like the Bronfman family, who were part of the shipping alcohol in the US, right? Bootlegging.
Through the French Islands.
Probably, yeah. No, I don't know too much of the details, but You don't stop this idea of organized crime. And the Bronfman are, they're not nice people. They're not cannibals, but they're part of the problem, this idea of the British Empire. There are people attacking this idea of nation state through institutions, through news media and stuff like that. So in a sense, what you have to look at is who is attacking nation states right now in the middle of this financial crisis?
That doesn't answer the question. Well, what was the difference? Why did we legalize the alcohol?
What I'm trying to tell you is that there's an attempt. I can't really answer about.
No, but it is good in your mind. Do you think good that alcohol is legalized?
Well, I mean, that's actually that's another debate. What I'm trying to tell you, because I can't argue about the prohibition stuff. People that want to legalize drugs are laughing. They're not trying to legalize drugs. Trying to put people on drugs. They're gonna use that idea. Oh my God, poor guy is suffering. He has cancer. Can't he just smoke his joint? Legalize. That's not their point. People like George Soros and the idea of a British opium war, which is, that's what's going on now. The idea is to destroy the mind. That's the intent. So, and it's very naive for people to think, okay, well, let's legalize, because they don't know who is involved into this. I mean, you could have, I forget the name of it. They have this pill based on the THX, you know?
THC.
I forgot the name. It's like Marinol or something, but you can actually transform as a pill. You know the famous,
the pills.
Like what helps in the joint. You know, you can put it in the pill.
Shit.
or as we said, as someone said, we can make it as a suppository. But you can use it as a pill. So then the point is that, are you gonna get the pill? Are you gonna let the pill circulate? Are you gonna produce it for people who needs it? No one, you know, if you can help alleviate suffering without destroying the brain, that's fine, right? But that's not really what's going on. People like George Soros,
yeah,
that's not their point.
Yeah, the problem, I mean, is that within this war, the ideas of cutting down on violence and making marijuana available for health reasons is really just a front to destroy nations.
So the difference between the prohibition and now is that in the prohibition, it was not George Soros taking advantage.
Well, I'm not too sure because he had a lot of...
No one answers. I mean,
well, do you
know, but look...
Say, okay, forget that question.
Do you know the history of the prohibition?
Well, I know just because they legalized it because organized crime was getting rich. Yeah,
but no, that's the thing. We have a book called Dope Inc. I haven't read, but which made us the expert on the subject of drugs and freaked out a lot of people. And I know we talk about it in the book because it's more complicated than that, right? You had Ottawa and Gatineau, the United States. There were different parts of Canada where it was legal or not, which were used in different ways. It's a bit more complex. I'm not quite aware. I mean, there's even people that were, people remember that from the 1932 probably, but the faction against Roosevelt was actually against prohibition, but there was also a front.
Yeah.
Was a front just to divide the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. So there's probably a lot of voices which you have to look into.
Yeah, and that's the thing you have to separate is intention for actually developing populations. You know, even something like prohibition is used as a political tool. Has nothing to do with that.
You can use anything as a political thing. I was just asking, what's the difference? I don't know. Thinking. So the circumstances are the difference.
If you go to a bar on say Catherine Street, I would say that there's no difference. I mean, bars are legalized drug pushing institutions, so there's no difference. And the same way that alcohol, if will destroy people, so will drugs. But the thing about drugs is that it's just...
So prohibition was a bad thing also. It was not just a good thing for eliminating the crime organization. It was a bad thing for destroying society.
Well, we're not going to solve that question. Here's what we're going to do. End of May, we're going to give a class on drugs and the prohibition.
Who?
Me?
Yeah.
Not just for you or for everyone, but...
Yeah,
you know,
nice.
Because that's something I wanted to do. And we're going to go through this book, Dope Inc., and all this Bronsman stuff. Because they were pretty much the group of the prohibition. But, all right, so why don't I just end up with, you know, because we want people to organize, and people should organize, we're not just trying to inform people. We have a plan. And... Mr. LaRouche, after his speech on the 11th, had a series of 4 points, which he mentioned as flanks, political flanks we have to use. And we can discuss about it probably after Matt's class. But the first point, what we got to do is that we have to recruit people from the lower 70% of the population, what LaRouche calls the organic leadership of that particular group. The reason is rather simple, is that the people at a higher level are whether so corrupt or brainwashed that the only thing that can get them to move, or some are probably also just depressed because they can't do shit, but the only thing that can get those guys to move is going to be by having, actually, as someone else said, a lynching mob for the good, where we can actually get city councilors, community leaders, student union leaders, and so on and so forth, to act on a national level and to get things to change from that aspect. The HBPA, the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act, the legislation by LaRouche, is, I think, a good example of how it works, because cities that want to survive realize that they have to intervene at the national level if they want to live, if they want to survive. It's not anymore a question of, you know, local budget or something. They're all broke, so they're all freaking out and they're attacking. They're endorsing a legislation to get the federal government to move. And that's something we have to do as well here. We got to go at groups that, whether are serious or should become serious, to start addressing LaRouche's solution for a new financial system. The second thing is what we discussed at the beginning, but we absolutely have to protect Mr. Obama from that behaviorist group and any bad influence coming from outside, coming from...
This is the second point?
That's the second point, yeah. Whether it comes from London or Washington, but the guy is a bit in love with himself. And I remember this book, Gargantua by Rabelais, which shows a good example of a king who starts a war, and but he's a bit of an idiot, but the problem are his advisors who are just telling him all these wet dreams about, you know, the ruler's wet dream, you're going to go in this country and then you're going to win everything. We're going to take their wine and we're going to go to the other city. Right? They have all this beautiful scheme. And the guy, the king, is like, oh, man, it's going to be so easy. And he falls in the trap. He's an idiot. But at the end, you see how Gargantua deals with it. And he deals in order to help this kingdom. Just kicks the king out and put his son in place, but puts the proper type of advisors there. And that's in a sense that will something that we got to do with Mr. Obama. And LaRouche says, you know, he's not an idiot. We can get something done, but we need to clean up the mess before.
We can make him look
good. Yeah, can make him look good, and yeah, and also obviously getting rid of Larry Summers. I didn't talk too much about it, but that's the Wall Street guy who's partially a behaviorist as well. But he's like the evil douchebag that we have to get rid of. The third point is this idea of a PCORA commission, where we want an investigation on this financial crisis. Who is responsible? Who has to go to jail? You know, not too many. We don't want to crowd the jails. And obviously put the basis so that the population knows exactly what's going on and what has to be done, and also pass the proper type of legislation to get rid of this crash and to really get rid of these crazy axioms. And the fourth point, which is I think an interesting point because it's a special flank in a sense, which is this idea of this issue with Senator Barney Frank, where Barney Frank is a senator who's been pushing for bailouts with Nancy Pelosi. And LaRouche says that Barney Frank has a streak of evil. He's not just stupid, he is calculating. He knows better. And if this guy collapses, then we're going to be able to really clean up the mess in the Congress of the United States with Pelosi and others. Because Barney Frank in 1989, I think that's where his weakness is. In 1989, he was involved in, I'll just read it. He was involved with another guy, Stephen Gobi, in running a homosexual prostitution ring out of his own apartment in Capitol Hill.
What's the guy, his partner's name?
Huh?
What was his partner's name?
Stephen Gobi, Gobie. And it was a big scandal, you know, like, what the hell, homosexual prostitution in D.C. And for some reason, someone shut down the investigation and the guy got reelected, no problem. So if we, obviously we're going to do our own research on that and figure out who shut down the investigation, so that's probably what it's going to give us a lot of names, and a lot of people will just start leaving the ship because they don't want to go to jail, and create a situation where our policies become.
Where was this? Where was this prostitution?
In D.C.
In D.C.
In the in Barney Frank's Capitol Hill apartment. You know, I mean, yeah, just sick. But that's how we're gonna get those guys to leave. And to go to jail or just to leave the whole place. To a lot of people that, you know, want to do good but just don't have the guts, and they don't have like our approach, so they tend to be kind of lazy or kind of too polite, you know. Can we discuss about maybe a potential for probably changing maybe this little thing? And obviously you don't do anything. So yeah, that's a bit what I wanted to cover. There's some other stuff, but I'll leave the place for Matt. Or maybe there's one or two questions. I can take the question. Otherwise, Matt.
I had a question about who's the DEA guy who's been working with Calderon towards keeping the drugs?
Eric Holder.
Was it
the Department of Justice?
Well, DEA is Drug Enforcement
Agency.
Holder is the Justice Department. I'm
just wondering if that operation is still going full force, or you know, what's the status on Holder's collaboration with Calderon?
I guess we'll know more after Obama discussed with Calderon. But obviously, in today's briefing, I didn't get a chance to read it, but we have, I can just give you a copy, but it's this document called A New Phase in Mexico-U.S. Cooperation to Eliminate Dope, Inc. It's more about the youth intervention.
No, but at the briefing, I think it was a press conference where Calderon and Obama were together announcing some things, but basically they were in collaboration together. They're going to work together to eliminate the drugs.
That's
the intention.
It was my understanding that Holder was kind of leading the charge on that.
Yeah.
Well, Holder is very serious about it, yeah.
He's the most hardcore anti-drug attorney general in the United States I've had in a long time.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
He's cleaning up the Department of Justice right now.
He's cleaning everything. You gotta know, he's cleaning a lot of corruption.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many things he's doing right now. He's a very busy guy right now. But
Eric Holder.
I think we can expect to hear a lot more from him. It's going to be... I wish I had more details, but I just have a general picture of what's going on. Mm-hmm.
Just pause it.
Yep.